Student Symposium here at Harvard Law School. My name is Ben Ponce. I am the president of the Harvard Federalist Society. The Federalist Society is a group of conservative and libertarian lawyers and law students that stands for three main principles: that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of powers is central to our Constitution, and that it's emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. Thank you for joining us tonight. We want to extend a special thank you to those who have financially supported this symposium, to those who are speaking at this symposium, and most especially to the more than 700 registered guests that are with us here in Cambridge. We know that at a balmy 44 degrees, Cambridge is indeed this year's hottest spring break destination. A few programming notes before we begin. Tonight's proceedings and the proceedings throughout the symposium will be streamed live on YouTube and available for viewing afterwards. Restrooms are located at this end on the wall behind me and at the other end of the hallway. And in case of emergency, please proceed to the nearest exit and note that you can exit via the courtyard. It's now my pleasure to introduce Professor Glenn Cohen. Professor Cohen is the James A. Atwood and Leslie Williams Professor of Law and Deputy Dean of Harvard Law School. He will give a few introductory remarks. Professor Cohen is one of the world's leading experts on bioethics. He teaches civil procedure as well as health law here at Harvard Law School, and among his administrative responsibilities as Deputy Dean includes working with student organizations, including the Federalist Society. Professor Cohen is a graduate of the University of Toronto and of Harvard Law School. He clerked on the First Circuit for Judge Michael Boudin. He worked at the Department of Justice and has served on the Harvard Law School faculty since 2006. He is a champion of the free exchange of ideas on this campus, and we're very grateful that he's joined us tonight to give a few welcoming remarks. Professor Cohen.
Did you hear me all right? How's that? No? Somewhere between? Well, we'll start with that. Okay. So, you know, at a gathering once upon a time, very much like this one, my then boss, Elena Kagan, when she was dean of Harvard Law School, famously said, "I love the Federalist Society, but you know, you're not my piece."
Probably loud enough anyways, but that's something Dean Kagan really did say. And I know this is probably a minority opinion in this room, but I don't tend to disagree with Justice Kagan. But here I will disagree for a moment with Justice Kagan in the following way. There are some real key ways where you are my people, and I think Justice Kagan's people as well. When you decide to spend an afternoon or a lunch hour at an evening like the State of Research on the Privileges or Immunities Clause, rather than playing Frisbee on the lawn with your friends, you are law nerds par excellence, chef's kiss, and you are very much my people. Second, you disagree a lot amongst yourselves, whether it's about the merits of originalism or what form of originalism, the right balance between the executive and Congress, or which of the justices is the true heir to Justice Scalia's textualism. When rather than suppress that disagreement, you revel in it, you revel in that disagreements amongst yourselves, you welcome it, and indeed you thrive in it, you are very much my people. And finally, while at HMS, and I'm sure at Gillette, and I'm sure many of the places many of you come from, you are typically not the modal view in our classrooms, but you are, as I describe them often, our FedSoc members, small but mighty in having your voices heard. When it's much easier to be intimidated, to be quiet, not to express yourselves, not to stand up for what you fervently believe in, and not to express it as eloquently as you do, you are very much my people when you resist those impulses and say the things you believe. So it's a pleasure and an honor to have you, my people, here at my school, Harvard Law School. I want to thank the organizers, and I hope that those of you who are visiting here for the first time will come back, and I hope you have an amazing weekend. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So as we transition into our first event of the evening, let me just say a few words about our symposium theme, Why Separate Powers? For many of us, I imagine this question seems like it could border on the banal. Indeed, of the last 42 student symposiums, no fewer than 9 of them have addressed some aspect of the separation of powers. But this year, we do hope to approach the question in a slightly different way. And to tell you about that approach, I'd like to tell you about a woman named Elizabeth Willing Powell. Many of you are doubtless familiar with the famous Pennsylvanian, Ben Franklin's famous statement on September 18, 1787, as the Constitutional Convention was wrapping up, that he said, "We would have a republic if you could keep it." Others of you are presumably familiar with Justice Gorsuch's book called A Republic, If You Can Keep It. Ben Franklin didn't make that statement sua sponte. Indeed, according to the Journal of Maryland delegate James McHenry, a woman named Elizabeth Willing Powell asked him, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" The daughter of the Philadelphia mayor and one of 11 children, Powell was by this point a Philadelphia socialite. Beginning with the First Continental Congress in 1774, she and her husband Samuel opened their home to delegates and hosted frequent dinner parties and salons to discuss the issues of the day. During the Revolutionary War, British soldiers commandeered her home and plundered her city, both episodes of which seem to have left a lasting impression. But by the time of the Constitutional Convention, Powell had resumed her hosting duties, witnessing lengthy and weighty deliberations about just what kind of government these states would form. So it likewise seems safe to assume that the question that she asked was truly what was on her mind. Would this new country be a monarchy or a republic? Her home having been seized during the war, she understood the stakes of arbitrary government power, and her question was one of structure and of process. Who would decide to what laws Americans would be subject? In our Constitution, the articles preceded the amendments, and questions of structure and of process are how we decide how to govern ourselves according to a rule of law. The conceit of this symposium is that as lawyers and law students, we have inherited an obligation from the likes of Elizabeth Willing Powell, someone who, of course, would not be able to vote in this new republic, but who cared very much nonetheless that it be a republic, to carry the promise that Franklin made to her and to us forward. Keeping our republic requires that we interrogate the reasons for our institutions, to care about them not only as means to ends we like, as means to ends we like and to obstruct ends that we dislike, but also to care about them as first order principles that shape the rule of law that we have chosen to uphold amongst ourselves. So we ask, why separate powers? And to help frame that question, it's now my privilege to welcome to the stage for a fireside chat, Professor Cass Sunstein and Judge Raymond Kethledge. Let me introduce both of them and then you can clap. Professor Cass Sunstein is the Robert Walmsley University Professor here at Harvard, where he has taught since 2008 after a 27-year career at the University of Chicago. Professor Sunstein teaches and writes in the areas of constitutional law, administrative law, public policy, behavioral economics, legal theory, among others. He is a graduate of Harvard College and of Harvard Law School. He also has served in government during the Obama administration. Most notably, he served as the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, sometimes known as OIRA. He clerked for Justice Benjamin Kaplan on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, as well as for Justice Thurgood Marshall. He is a prolific author of many books. His CV that is on the Harvard website is rather long. My favorite of his books is titled One Case at a Time, Judicial Minimalism on the Supreme Court. And he'll be joined in conversation tonight by Judge Raymond Kethledge, who has served on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit since 2008. Judge Kethledge is a graduate of the University of Michigan and of the University of Michigan Law School. He clerked on the Sixth Circuit for Judge Ralph Guy and on the United States Supreme Court for Justice Anthony Kennedy. He also worked in the Senate for Senator Spencer Abraham and in private practice in Michigan. He has taught appellate advocacy and federal courts at the University of Michigan, and he teaches a seminar here at Harvard Law School called Classical Liberalism and the Rule of Law. It was exactly 1 year ago today, sitting in that very symposium, that on the back of a paper on which he had made a couple of comments, I flipped it over and began to sketch out this very symposium. So it's very personally rewarding to me that this symposium has come about about exactly 1 year to the day after that incident, and that we get to share all of that with you tonight. So we've asked Professor Sunstein and Judge Kethledge to address three questions. First, is the separation of powers necessary to the rule of law? Second, must free societies avoid concentrating power to maintain their liberal character? And third, to what extent does the American system of separating powers support or obstruct the people's liberty? Please now join me in welcoming Professor Cass Sunstein and Judge Raymond Kethledge.
All right, can you hear us? Can you hear me? I think it is on. The light's on.
Is this one audible?
Can use our trial voice.
How's this? Hello, hello. Hello, hello.
I think that's
yay.
That's working. Is mine working? Yeah.
That I think was an exercise in the separation of powers. You just saw it for real. So our first question is the separation of powers necessary for the rule of law. I think I want to pause for a moment and say first, thank you all for doing this and for having us. And second, that Justice Scalia, among others, said that legislative history is like looking over a room and finding your friends. I'm kind of doing that now and seeing many people who are friends. So it's wonderful to see you. Hi, Eugene Meyer. Thank you for being here. Hi, former students galore. Thank you for being here. This is the issue we're now discussing is much debated among separation of powers aficionados. And I think I'd like to say that the word necessary might mean logical necessity, like 2 + 2 = 4. Separation of powers and rule of law don't have that quality. There have been societies in the history of humanity, Professor Vermeule has recently written about this, that have embraced the rule of law, not the separation of powers. But I think I want to say it's a neat trick to have the rule of law without the separation of powers. And if this is boring you a little bit, I want to say that we are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is not only Harvard. It's where someone on a horse rode to Concord, Massachusetts, not Paul Revere, someone who's actually more important to the alerting to the presence of British. And so we're right near the foundation of the American Revolution, to which the separation of powers and the rule of law were crucial. If you don't separate the legislature and the judiciary, then Houston, as Tom Hanks famously said before he was an actor, when he was an astronaut, Houston, we have a problem, because the separation of legislative and judicial power is essential to preservation of liberty under law. If you don't separate the legislative power and the executive power, there must be some saying from some movie in which Tom Hanks starred, maybe when he played a little kid and was jumping joyfully. Remember that one? He was like 19 years old, but he was really 35. Okay, if you don't separate the legislative and executive
power. It's called Big.
Big, that's the name of the book. Okay, Big.
They're a different generation.
This is a big point that separation of the legislative and executive power is essential to liberty because the executive's authority to say, no, we're not going to prosecute you, is a safeguard of human freedom. The separation of executive power and judicial power is also essential, not in the logical sense, but in the empirical sense to liberty. If the executive power and the judicial power are fused, then the ability to preserve human liberty against the power of the executive, and I'm looking at Professor McConnell, who's written on this kind of thing with great eloquence, that's a Judge McConnell, Professor McConnell, both. Two honoraria, but not financial. Two names. The separation of those authorities, that is executive and judicial, is also essential to liberty. So a theme is emerging, isn't it? that liberty, which is a function of a rule of law that includes rules laid down in advance, that includes transparency rather than confusion and mess, that involves prospectivity rather than retroactivity, that involves a right to a hearing, et cetera. These are foundational components of liberty, and separation of powers is, in ordinary language, I submit, essential to that, the rule of law, though not as a logical necessity, essential to that.
Yeah, I would agree, I think, with everything you just said. Can you hear me all right? I think that, well, first of all, I want to say that I really am honored to be here at Harvard Law School on this stage with this man, Professor Cass Sunstein, whom I've greatly admired for a long time, both not only as a scholar, but as a person. And so I really am humbled to be here tonight with you, Cass. So I think to talk about whether we need to separate powers and the relationship between the separation of powers and the rule of law, I think it's helpful to try to talk about what the rule of law is. And I would submit that a decent working formulation of that is that the rule of law is a condition in which the state may coerce an individual only in the enforcement of a known rule that applies equally to everyone. So that's a mouthful, all right? But for purposes of the separation of powers, I think what matters is that it means the state can coerce you only if you break a legal rule. And so a legal rule, you know, being for example, you can't distribute methamphetamine, you can't commit assault, et cetera, et cetera. And so then how does the separation, well, the antithesis to that then is what we have in unfree societies, which is coercion by will, where political opponents fall out of windows, or they get gunned down walking across a bridge, or they're sent to a gulag north of the Arctic Circle, all by the will of some government official. And so how does the separation of powers then help prevent coercion by will, would be the question. I guess my answer, and I don't claim originality for it, but my answer is not that there's this mutual jealousy between the branches and they're gonna be sort of guarding their prerogatives and making sure another branch doesn't kind of go beyond its powers. I think the legal history of the 20th century shows actually quite the contrary, that at least the judicial and the legislative branch have been quite willing at times to cede substantial power to the executive. So what is it then about the separation of powers? I would suggest that what is most important about the separation of powers is the requirement that any particular act of coercion be approved by three different branches. The requirement that it have the concurrence of three branches. And so, you know, let's say, for example, a money laundering statute. You need, in order to be coerced for money laundering, the Congress needs to pass a law that prescribes money laundering, which is actually a complicated offense. And then the executive needs to choose to enforce that law against some individual, presumably based on a belief that person engaged in conduct that violates the legal boundary drawn by that rule. And then an impartial judge needs to first agree, probably, with the government's interpretation of the legal rule, and then probably a jury would have to find facts, namely that the person engaged in conduct that violates the rule as interpreted by the court. That's a lot of concurrences, and it would be difficult to coerce by will someone who had not violated the rule when you have the requirement of those three concurrences. And so I think that the separation of powers by making coercion by will so difficult. The separation of powers, I agree it's not logically necessary to the rule of law, but as a practical matter, I think it's as a practical matter, at least looking at Anglo-American legal history, which are the kind of blinders that I have, I think it is essential, and that we consolidate power at our peril. I mean, Professor Sunstein talked about a couple of particular combinations of power. So if you combine the executive and the legislative powers, I mean, what could a malevolent actor do with both of those powers is one way to think about this. And so, you know, the first thing I would do if I were that actor is I would write a vague law. That allows me to target individuals for prosecution based on my will. But this isn't about whether they deserve it. It's I want to get certain people. I might have an enemies list, what have you. And so I'm going to write a vague law. You know, you can't do things to the detriment of national security or disturb the public order or whatever it might be. And then I'll go ahead and prosecute that person. Now, there is a check in that scenario, which is that you still have a judiciary that has to sign off on the idea that you're correctly interpreting this rule and that this person, in fact, engaged in that conduct. That said, I mean, as Robert Jackson said in a speech in 1940 to a conference of U.S. attorneys, I mean, Robert Jackson was truly a great man. And so he says to a conference of U.S. attorneys that the prosecutor has more coercive power than any person in America. And so there can be an awful lot of coercion in terms of deprivation of your liberty and property before the judiciary signs off. So this isn't, you know, the separation of powers is not an airtight solution. Judicial plus legislative, well, in the old days, that looked like bills of attainder. We haven't had one of, you know, a bill of attainder is when the legislature passes a law which doesn't prescribe a general rule like thou shalt not kill or whatever. It prescribes a particular outcome that so-and-so is guilty of treason and shall be punished and forfeit all his lands and property. That's what a bill of attainder looks like. We haven't had one of those since 1706, so I think we're in the clear. And the Constitution actually specifically forbids them. The more likely scenario, and one that I think unfortunately does happen, is where, so part of the judicial power is to declare what the law is. It's only an incidental power, by the way. It's incidental to doing what is the real judicial power, which is, as Chief Justice Marshall said, he said the province of the judiciary is solely to decide on the rights of individuals. That's it. We just decide the rights of disputants in front of us. As an incident to that, we have to declare what the law is, because to decide the case, you have to say what the rule is. And so the court has the power to say what the law is. And if I bring an agenda to my decision in a case. Let's say I just think there are just way too many class actions, and we're just gonna start to crack down. You know, Rule 23 is sort of closed for business as far as I'm concerned. And so that's the rule of civil procedure where it specifies the requirements to certify a class. If I'm gonna introduce my will into that, I will distort that rule, which is in a sense legislating, and that will result in either an absence of coercion where maybe there should be, or coercion where there shouldn't be. The thing about the judicial and legislative combination is at least the judiciary is passive. Okay, we can't go get cases. It's like being in a deer blind. I mean, the deer has to come to you. You can't go to the deer. Okay, and if the deer doesn't come by, then it doesn't happen. Right. The potential damage is limited in this instance. What I think is the really dangerous combination, short of a total consolidation, the really dangerous combination is the executive and the judiciary, because The executive can choose his targets. They can go roaming around and go get the people they want. So you have that executive power to bring a prosecution. Meanwhile, if you're also exercising the judicial power, that has in it the power I just mentioned, the power to declare what the law is in that particular case. And so this executive who has judicial power has really a quasi-legislative power in that case to say what the law is. And then that same prosecutor, so to speak, who's bringing the case also determines liability or in a civil case or guilt or innocence. That is it. So that combination really does, I submit, open the door to coercion by will and to undermining the rule of law. And it's that combination I think is particularly dangerous.
I thought that was fantastic, if I may say. What I loved about it was the crisp definition of the rule of law as coercion only pursuant to clear rules laid down in advance. The kind of canonical understandings of the rule of law are more eight-part. You know, prospectivity, no retroactivity, operates mm-hmm. in the world as it does on the books, no inconsistency or unduly rapid changes in the law, clear and transparent, and there are one or two others. Simpler is better. I also love the thought that we need three concurrences before coercion is brought to bear against persons. And when we think of the American Revolution and the concern about taxes, et cetera, and arbitrary taxes and taxation without representation, there's a connection with what the judge was saying. So I thought that was fantastic. I'm thinking that there are a few other things which are not primary, but which are relevant. And so let me throw them out there as separation of powers benefits, which are associated with the rule of law, but maybe not reducible to it. One is our founders wanted a deliberative democracy. That is a system that combined accountability with reason giving. And that was in some ways a tremendous innovation over previous understandings of self-government, where the old Republican idea of virtue and the common good was maintained through a sense of reason giving by deliberative institutions, and in which accountability was front and center, but not the only thing front and center. Now, if you think of a separation of powers, if it's working well, it's not essential to deliberative democracy, but it's really valuable. So that if you have a Congress and an executive that are in different hands, then the notion that there will be a process of reflection and consideration before laws are built, that's increased. And if you have a judiciary which has multiple means, let's say, of oversight, all of which are grounded in law, but they might include, let's just say hypothetically, the arbitrary or capricious test. You're supposed to applaud at that. Have you not taken, that's like yeah. the best thing ever, the arbitrary and capricious test. Okay, call that an echo of founding era ideals, maybe a loud echo, and that allows a constraint through the independent judiciary on executive arbitrariness. That's really important. I think I'd like to say that coercion is primary, but if you think of the separation of powers, there are other things that government does. I'm thinking, how many people, you know, raise your hand, that's a little too morning TV shows that are sentimental. Don't raise your hand, but think not who you love, that then it would be really morning TV shows, but think of whether you flew in and whether you went through federal authorities and TSA and if the FAA were relevant to you, and maybe you saw TSA people. There's something going on there in the FAA and TSA which certainly have to do with coercion, but it's not only that, and this is more of a Hamiltonian theme. It's about a well-functioning apparatus, and give me any day a system of separation of powers, or at least most days, a system of separation of powers if you want a well-functioning apparatus, rather than a system in which power is concentrated in some. And we might say that our system of separation of powers isn't just any system of separation of powers. It has a distinctly constituted, executive, legislative, and judicial branch, with the legislature having its various components, which are designed to promote deliberative processes, as well as protection of minority rights, an executive, which is unitary, more or less, but.
Just unitary.
Know, let's just say.
Just a joke.
Unitary
just a joke.
More.
I have to be careful. Yeah.
let's say that everyone agrees the presidency is unitary. What that particularly entails, there's disagreement about, yes? But let's say that the idea that, let's say that the idea that there's one president rather than 18, we agree with that. And that's really important. It has to do with something that's essential in the founding view to execution of the laws. That's a particular conception of the separation of powers. It's not inevitable. And the judiciary has life tenure, salary protection.
Yeah.
And that's
such as it is.
And that's salary protection, not salary so much. But that, and that's important. Yes. Mm-hmm. So think of that as part of a process that safeguards institutions that are going to coerce people if and only if, and also institutions that are designed to promote a well-functioning system, meaning TSA and the FAA basically work.
I agree with, I think, everything you said there. I mean, one thing to mention is that the separation of powers can take different forms. You know, it's not just this, like, binary thing. Either you have, you know, a complete separation or no separation. And I would suggest that the separation of powers, in fact, I mean, let me step back. I mean, the Constitution is mostly an arrangement of institutions that evolved over time. They didn't sit down and think about, you know, the idea of having 12 people determine guilt. That actually started in the 12th century under Henry II. You know, the bicameral legislature. Professor McConnell has written a book that describes how all the different prerogative powers of the king were distributed among different branches in the Constitution. I mean, there was some novel stuff that they kind of made up themselves, and those kinds of things turned out very differently than they expected. The Electoral College has not turned out at all like they expected, but like some things that people adopt for one reason, they sometimes have benefits that nobody anticipated either. But I mean, the separation of powers, I think you can go back as far as Magna Carta and clearly see then a separation of powers. And so at that time, you know, it's King John in the running for the worst king ever in England. And at that time, there isn't a legislature. King John himself is not prescribing rules of conduct. Law is based on custom. Custom is generated by patterns of human conduct over time. It's generated by human action. So the lawmaking function is entirely separate from the executive, from King John, who basically has all the power of the state. Somehow, the lawmaking function is separate from King John because it takes the form of custom. It's just things people are doing. So in the early 13th century, after about 1204, and King John has lost all of their possessions in France, he needs to get money. And so he starts violating the custom of the time, which was feudal custom. He starts brazenly violating customary limitations on different ways he can extract revenue from the barons. And I won't bore you with things like feudal aids and wardships and so on. But just trust me, he's violating all these traditional limitations. And finally, the barons get to the point where they realize they must revolt against him or else they're going to just be sub. And they made a very clear distinction in their minds then between decisions made by law and by will. They consciously made that distinction and they feared they would be entirely subject to the will of John. So they revolt and it's a kind of a short civil war. They ultimately force King John, the King of England, they force in this, in this epochal moment in Anglo-American history to recognize specific discrete limits on his power in a written document, no less. And so 40 years later, Henry of Bracton, who was this renowned, he was the great treatise writer of this era, he writes words which are inscribed above the steps to Langdale Hall, 500 feet away from here, in the stone, which is, "The king is under no man, but under God and law." The king is under law. And the king, King John was only, and he's writing that only because Magna Carta happened. King John was under law because he lacked the power to change it. If he could have changed the law, he would not be under the law. He would not be limited by the law. And so it was that original kind of spontaneous separation between the king and the lawmaking function that subjects the king to limitations by law. And had they not been separated, there would not have been that limitation. And so, and then you go forward to the beginning of the 17th century. There's this struggle between law and power, which is unending to this day. So law wins that one. During the Tudor period, you have what's called the Tudor absolutism. Power gets the upper hand. Then the Stuarts start taking over, and they kind of want to close that deal. And King James wants to arrogate to himself legislative power and judicial power. And the Winston Churchill of English legal history, Edward Coke, to his face tells James, you lack the power to do this. And by the way, you don't know anything about the law. So Coke is not invoking the separation of powers as such. Nobody is up to this time. He's just spelling out the demands of the common law, the customary law. He's being descriptive, not prescriptive. And it's only during the English Civil War that people then look back at these recent decisions and realize there is this separation. And that's when we first start hearing about the term separation of powers. So then let's go forward till after our revolution. The state constitutions, the evolved form of separation of powers had what we would call checks and balances. The king had an absolute veto over legislation. Now, gradually that falls into disuse. But the king had this check on the legislative power. He could also suspend parliament. After 1776, a number of states, especially Pennsylvania, decide that separation of powers is a really good thing, and they decide to purify it. Let's have just pure separation of powers. The governor has no veto power whatsoever. There isn't going to be any judicial review. It really hadn't even started yet. They weren't like trying to prescribe it. But they make the branches truly entirely independent. And what happens, it turns out, they wanted a complete separation. It turns out if you just kind of make them independent and they fend for themselves, the legislative branch takes over everything. It actually starts consolidating the power of the other ones because they start passing these laws that dictate particular outcomes. One thing they loved to do was vacate final judgments of courts. And so the court would enter a judgment in some debtor's case or whatever it might be, and they would legislatively say, judgments entered during this time frame, and they would specify the cases. They're vacated. So the judiciary is neutralized, and they might pass a law that specifies who must be in the cabinet of the executive, and then maybe how the decision-making has to happen for the executive. So it evolves over time. Madison in Federalist 47 and 48 points to that experience and says, you can't have this pure separation. There has to be these checks and balances where the branches can prevent the other ones from intruding upon their powers. Now, like I said, that hasn't worked out perfectly. But so it is something that evolves over time, and there are different forms of it, and we have a certain form that's that's specified in the written constitution. You can go a long time now.
I'm thinking as you were talking, and especially your, I thought, elegant transition from England to the United States of a patron saint of this discussion, Bob Dylan, who sang, "Sometimes even the President of the United States has to stand naked," and who, when in the United Kingdom, was kind of inventing modern rock and roll. They were booing him in England. And he said, "Come on, it's not British music, it's American music." And the last bits you heard were American music, and I want to sing some American music. Don't get scared. The Steele seizure case is hovering over us. If you don't know the Steele seizure case, it's a case in which the President of the United States had to stand naked in the midst of a war. He wanted to seize the steel mills, and the Supreme Court said, you can't. And whatever opinion you like, there are various magnificent opinions, I think, in the Steele seizure case. They all said there's a sharp separation between the legislative authority and the executive authority, and the President of the United States can't even, in the name of national security, claim an emergency power which allows him to seize steel mills. That's an American song, and that suggests, consistent with what the judge said, that the separation of powers is, with respect to some things, really close to essential to the rule of law. So see the Steele seizure case as a rule of law case. The most brilliant opinion in the case was written by Justice Jackson, a hero of mine also, who wrote the greatest sentence in the history of the Supreme Court of the United States. Don't argue. That's not the sentence. That's my plea. The sentence is, compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. That's a sentence which is, I think, electrifying. In certain times in American history, and maybe this is one, compulsory unification achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. Think, if you would, of for a moment, maybe with grief, of recent events in Russia, and think for a moment, if you would, with jubilation of some things which are enduring in this nation. So Steele seizure case, compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. Good luck with compulsory unification of opinion in a system of separated powers. Good luck with that. You won't get it. The other case, which the judge's comments reminded me of, I hadn't thought of it for this, is a case of surpassing beauty. It doesn't have Jackson's poetic quality, but it's called the Papachristou case. It's a case about vagueness. It's a law that basically in Jacksonville, Florida, said if you're doing something the police don't like, you can be arrested for vagrancy. And the Supreme Court unanimously said that's void for vagueness, and it said, the court said two things that were about separation of powers and vagueness. Vagueness is a due process idea, but it turns out to be a separation of powers case also. It says that people don't, in Jacksonville, they didn't have fair notice. They didn't know what they had to do to avoid an unhappy encounter with the police. That's a horrifying abridgment of liberty. And the court said a second thing, not the fair notice point, that people in Jacksonville are subject to the arbitrary exercise of discretion by the executive officers. Where arbitrary is, in this case, a beautiful pun, arbitrary might mean random, which is really bad, yes? That you drew a bad lottery ticket and you're in jail. Or it might mean invidious, which is also really bad, which might mean that your skin color isn't the right one, or maybe you're not dressed right, or maybe you're the wrong age. And the Papachristou case, the void for vagueness case, it's a backdoor separation of powers case. It says to the legislature, you better separate the powers between you and the executive, otherwise the due process clause is going to stand in your way.
Okay. One thing that I think in fairness one should talk about when we're kind of celebrating the separation of powers is what you sometimes hear from the British perspective on this, which is that it creates deadlock. You know, there was a Lord Chancellor, I don't remember the gentleman's name, who spoke down the hall, and he talked about how, you know, we don't have it and we don't need it. Now they do have it more than they realize, because the judiciary really is separate. But his point was that the executive is actually kind of is de facto a subgroup of the legislature. And so you have that degree of consolidation, and they both, in all of the, and the majority of the legislature and the subgroup, you know, the cabinet, whatever, they belong to the same political party. And he was saying that in our system, when you have not only separated powers, but divided powers. So, you know, you have the three branches are separated, but then the legislative branch, at least if we're doing it by Article 1, Section 7, like the Constitution says, you go down and it's divided into two chambers, the House and the Senate. And then the president obviously either has to sign the legislation, or you need an overwhelming majority in the form of two-thirds of the members of each house to support it. And so his point was, and Charles McIlwain had some of the same concerns during the Depression era. He was a great scholar of constitutionalism. The concern is that there are too many requirements here. You know, you have to get all these concurrences to pass legislation, and this does resonate today, I would submit. And there might be an urgent problem or two that the country needs to address, but because of the multiplicity of concurrences to pass legislation, you can't get it passed. That's what the criticism is. And I mean, there's no question we have deadlock now. I mean, really, in the last month. I mean, it's been remarkable. And so, you know, it makes one wonder, I mean, is there a flaw in our separation of powers arrangement? I mean, former Lord Chancellor thought so. I mean, I'm not sure. There is no mechanical solution. Once you get to a certain degree of dysfunction, I think there is no mechanical solution for it. And so I would not necessarily lay kind of what we've been witnessing at the doorstep of separation of powers. Maybe it enables it to some extent, but I the framers were not utopians by any means, and they didn't have this kind of utopian vision of man's goodness. Quite the contrary, I would say. That said, and others might know better than I, Michael McConnell might probably surely knows better than I, but I bet that they thought that a critical mass of legislators would at least be trying to answer the same question, which is what's at the end of the day, what's best for the country, not what's best for the party, not what's going to get me on a cable TV show, whatever. What's best for the country, and we, through most of our history, we had that. I think, you know, you had Reagan and Tip O'Neill getting together. You had Sam Nunn and Phil Gramm. We called these people adults. And if you just don't have a critical mass of people, if the members of these bodies are not trying to answer the same question, or the question just isn't what's good for the country, then I don't think separation of powers can, I don't think there's a mechanical arrangement that is going to fix that.
It's a fantastic question. So I'm thinking 2008, 2009, it's funny how memory recedes, but in Washington, D.C., the stores were all closed. So I'm not wearing one of the 17 suits I got, because you could buy them for a nickel in Washington, D.C., 85 cents for 17 suits, but it was a horror in all over the country then. We were on the verge of a depression, maybe, and certainly it's called the Great Recession. It was extremely dangerous, and laws were passed that helped, and that we didn't have a depression. And separation of powers, whether it was ideal, it wasn't a preventative measure. And a more vivid example, maybe, just because of its drama, is after 9/11, a bunch of things had to be done to secure the nation against the threats, and they were done. Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans worked together. Mm-hmm. So what I'm thinking is, with respect to many crises, the adults, or at least the near adults who know the stakes are very high, they do work together. It happens. Whether we have optimal separation of powers and optimal gridlock or excessive gridlock, it's very hard to work by arithmetic to figure that out. I share the intuition that the level of gridlock we observe is excessive, and in some ways worse now than it was. Maybe all of you are older than I am, so you'll remember, as I don't. Maybe 20 years ago, it was better. And there are some reasons for that. I think I wouldn't lay the blame at separation of powers. Mm-hmm. I'd lay the blame at some other things that make the system of separation of powers, on occasion, produce undesirable gridlock. But note, if you would, that gridlock is sometimes a good idea. It's a matter of the executive saying no to a legislature that's excessively energized. And it might be a matter of the legislature saying no to an executive that's in the grip of something. And so sometimes gridlock is preservative of liberty and rationality.
And that was certainly the design. Justice Gorsuch, as he points out in his Gundy dissent, Article 1, Section 7, bicameralism and presentment is designed to be hard to meet. What else do you want to talk about? You want to talk about that? Or
I'm happy to talk about non-delegation, so if we like. So I think we can agree that, I think Americans can agree that that it's very important to separate legislative and executive authority, at least I hope so. If the legislature tells the executive to issue rules that are requisite to protect the public health with an adequate margin of safety, there's a question, and it's a fair question, whether that's a blank check. And then we have to parse mm-hmm. what those words mean. It might mm-hmm. be in context. Those words are pretty constraining. I think mm-hmm. Justice Scalia thought so. If they aren't, if those words give a large amount of policy discretion, one view, which is kind of on the historical ascendancy, is that Congress can do that. That's to my surprise. Seems to be historically, its stock has risen over the last...
Are you talking about the Mortenson and Bagley article?
Yeah, and there are mm-hmm. about five others, all of which are reaching the same basic result. Whether that's... I'd like the non-delegation doctrine in some form. Mm-hmm. As a non-originalist, I would be for it even if the history were the other way. I think it's textually plausible and structurally essential. But how much to enforce it is an extremely fair question. And the idea of going hard at words like requisite to protect the public health with an adequate margin of safety, mm-hmm. it's not clear that's what America needs now.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the historical point, I know Julian, and he's a friend, and I respect him a lot. And he's going to be here this weekend. And he's just another one of these people who is, like you, frankly, are just exemplary in their civility and the way they engage with different points of view. But I'm not as impressed, frankly, by the article. I mean, I think that it has some things that are similar to the core executive or legislative power of prescribing rules of conduct that bind the citizenry. There's some first cousins and second cousins. I mean, a second cousin would be, that there was some kind of delegation in a statute to the executive to have kind of plenary power over quarantining aliens that come into the United States. And yes, that does limit liberty, but I just have a very strong instinct that that's a different animal than the thou shalt not for the citizenry that that is really what, I mean, Justice Gorsuch had his description of the legislative power, and which is that it's rules that are binding on the conduct of like particular individuals or something like that. And I just didn't see too many examples of that. There's sort of regulation in the territories and that sort of thing. Obviously the framers were very influenced by John Locke in that article. And there's kind of a counter article by Professor Werman on the history. And so, I mean, there's a dispute about what Locke means. It's the only reason I know is because we just taught it in class yesterday. I'm not trying, this is not pedantry. It's section 141 of Locke's Second Treatise of Government, where he says, of course it is, where he says that in just unequivocal terms, that the legislature cannot delegate its power to anyone else. And it says it cannot transfer, in fairness, cannot transfer its power to anyone else. And the power that is delegated to the legislature, they cannot transfer. Those words, delegate and transfer, are in fact used that way. And the Mortenson and Bagley article says, well, transfer is different than delegation. Transfer is a permanent alienation, like Congress is just permanently ceding its power to the executive. And so, I mean, one can make kind of a linguistic argument about that. But the problem, I think, with that argument is the rest of what Locke says in section 141, where, I mean, he just formulates this three or four different ways. And he says, and the people are bound only by such laws as are made by those men, being the people, the legislature to which this power was delegated from the people, and that they are not bound by any laws not made by such men. Again, talking about the legislators, and he said, what is granted is a power to legislate, not a power to make legislators. I mean, I read that in context, and I think he's saying categorically that any putative laws that are made by anyone other than the delegatees of the legislative power, i.e. the legislature, are not binding. Now, it's not to say that Locke's Second Treatise is part of the federal constitution, but if we're trying to understand the history, I mean, there was no political philosopher, I would submit, who was more influential on the framers than John Locke. I just don't agree with the reading of Locke that he's fine with delegating to the executive to make these same laws that are going to bind everybody. One thing, both of us are Hayekians, right? And so the one through thread that runs through Hayek's writing is just this posture of intellectual humility, just a recognition of the severe limitations on the knowledge of any one individual. I don't have perfect knowledge about American history, and the folks who have written those articles on either side have looked at it more directly than I have. And so, I mean, I think one thing I just wanted to say tonight, because, you know, it's kind of a divisive time in the country. And I think that we should always be open to elements of truth and opinions that we don't agree with, or to just proven wrong, you know? But that's my sense of it, is the history doesn't support it. And the Constitution says all legislative power shall be vested in the Congress. I mean, I don't think the meaning of all has changed since that time. And if all legislative power is vested in the Congress. And then the question is, well, can they, you know, can they pass it on to somebody else? And I guess, I'm not going to say too much, all right? but I mean, to maybe go to the particulars of the non-delegation doctrine. I mean, like Justice Gorsuch says, he doesn't have any problem with fact-finding by the executive and with filling in the details. And it's kind of fascinating to think about what those might be. You know, it could be, Congress might pass a law proscribing imports from countries that make a certain use of, like, child labor, okay? And Congress doesn't know who those countries are, or they needn't know, but they could just say that and let the executive make the finding based on the executive's very likely much greater knowledge, particularly in real time, about what countries are doing that. So that's a fact finding and filling in the, I don't know. I had it filling in the details, but I forgot what it was.
Okay, this is great. So keep in mind that there's, okay, so to your comment about humility, Learned Hand said during World War II, the spirit of liberty is that spirit which is not too sure that it is right. Pause over that. The word too, T-O-O, is beautiful, because he's not saying the spirit of liberty is not that spirit which is not sure that it's right. That's kind of pathetic, but not too sure that it is right, meaning you know you might be wrong, but you still have a conviction, and that's American music. Okay, American music with respect to the non-delegation doctrine. I don't think there's anything in these very impressive historical accounts that's inconsistent with the view that if Congress said, President, do whatever you see fit to make the climate change problem better, that would be okay. Mm-hmm. I think there's nothing in the history that suggests that's okay.
And that's Schechter. Right?
And that's very arguably Schechter. Mm-hmm. So that's really important, isn't it? To say that open-ended grants of authority are unacceptable, and we now have an account of what the separation of powers is for. The judge's three concurrences point, and maybe the deliberative democracy point as a trailing theme, and that suggests that's no good. Now, the difference as I see it is between Justice Gorsuch's view, which is fill in the details, find facts, and Justice Kagan's view, which is intelligible principle. These are disagreements that can be pretty intense, but they're within the family disagreements. That is the difference between saying you need an intelligible principle, as she understands it, which gives Congress some license, and saying you can fill in the facts, you can find the facts or fill in the details. It's a difference of degree, and it might really matter. But it's all within, let's say, I want to say the American legal tradition, but I have to say it's all within the Anglo-American tradition. Forgive me, Mr. Dillon. We're singing some British music here also. And notice, if you would, I think, that under the intelligible principle test, there are some very broad grants of authority which would be questionable. And under the fill in the facts, fill in the details or find the facts, there would have to be some evidently broad grants of discretion that are just fine, because once you parse them in context, they're not so open-ended. So here's an example, and this is one dear to my heart. I might start to tear up. If Congress says, regulate toxic substances to the extent that the benefits justify the costs, are you all feeling like deep emotion here? Is it the Star Spangled Banner is playing? And
cost benefit. Here we go. It took you an hour.
Gosh. But it was implicit in everything. The separation of powers has benefits that way exceed costs. Liberty too. But if there's cost benefit analysis as the rule of decision, is that going to be struck down? That would be a very provocative claim, because cost benefit analysis as non-arbitrarily. Am I completely losing you here? Cost-benefit analysis as non-arbitrarily carried out is not, I want to do this, I want to do that. The difference between a Republican and Democratic administration with respect to the application of cost-benefit analysis is narrow.
Well, I mean, I'm for cost-benefit analysis. I mean, there's not enough of it, right? I mean, I'm out of my depth, mm-hmm. but I like it. And I certainly agree that, you know, intelligible principle and fill in the details, they're both within the American legal tradition. I mean, we're not talking about like illiberalism or something here. I think the court hasn't really explored this very much, right? And I don't know if that tells us anything. But I think the question is really, you know, the legislative power is a power to prescribe rules of conduct. I mean, the core of it, that are binding on people. Like if you violate them, you get punished. And so the question, if we have a non-delegation doctrine, the question is who in this instance is writing the rule? I don't intuit how the intelligible principle answers that. I mean, or at least how it reassures us that Congress has written a rule. It's like it's a principle. I mean, it's a blob or something. It's like a level of generality that hasn't reduced itself to a rule. I mean, rules are trade-offs. If Congress passed a law saying the Department of, and for all I know they have, saying the Department of Energy shall promulgate legislative rules, as they put it, reasonable rules for having like fuel efficient heating and cooling in the house, all right? So it's just, you know, reasonable rules to get to this outcome. Now, I would think that maybe Congress would actually have to specify some sort of hierarchy in the trade-offs that the agency should make. I mean, if it's just like, give me reasonable rules, well, it's always trade-offs. I mean, nothing's free, right? Everything's scarce. There's always scarcity we have to deal with if we're talking about any kind of economic issue. And so how do you make the trade-off? And if Congress is really, really writing the rule and the agency is using its expertise to fill in details, it would seem like perhaps they have to specify this is the most important thing, and these two things are pretty important, but not as important as that thing, but keep in mind this thing, and then have a reasonable answer to how you do those trade-offs. I mean, that's one thing, but just like reasonable, and then everybody's got to get a heat pump 10 years later. I mean, that feels like legislation from the executive, if that were to happen.
I think whatever we think of the details, to the second point raised by our president in the room, not in Washington, our local president, which is about concentration of power, the statement just made is connected with that. And I would say that if anything, the centuries since the US Constitution speak more loudly to the continuing horror of concentration of power. Mm-hmm. That what we've observed and what we observed is testimony to the correctness of the American rejection of concentration of power. I was in China a number of years ago, actually, and I taught. It's too perfect. I taught Papachristou, the vagueness case. And the reason I taught it was I wanted it to be a kind of background principle before we did American administrative law. Because in the US, when you teach Papachristou, it's usually kind of old and dusty and self-evidently right. And in among my Chinese students who were between the ages of 30 and 50 and were all but one members of the party, that that opinion was like an explosion in the air. And I couldn't believe their feeling, their evident sense of inspiration and awe. And I asked them after, why was Papa Christou producing that reaction? It was a background case. And the answer was, they said quietly, reading Papa Christou makes communism seem very dark. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't say that on the record. But it was about the freedom-maintaining characteristic of separating, in that case, legislative and executive authority, with the judiciary there to police the boundary.
Mm-hmm. So you...
I mean, one thought I have hearing you and talking is that it's that... And I wonder if you've all felt this a little bit over the past whatever period, that that among people who prize the American constitutional order, let's say, the debates are important and sometimes fierce, but they are within a domain of commonality. And and I think it's the liberal tradition broadly understood. If you don't like that word, then there's another word. But that's kind of, as these things go, thrilling to observe. And you know, if we could talk a little bit about the unitary executive in its contested form, whether the independent agencies are legitimate or not.
Sure, whatever, yeah.
And that is connected with the separation of powers. The Jackson, you know, a hero of mine, referred to a fourth branch of government and thought that was a constitutional atrocity. And there's a conception of independent agencies. I think it's not the conception with which we live that gives rise to the concern that it is a concentration of powers. And of course, the Consumer Bureau case in the Supreme Court, Saylor Law, reflected an insistence on the separation of powers, such that if you had an agency that was operating free from presidential control and combining, in a sense, traditionally separated powers, that's a constitutional violation. So these are really important issues to sort out. Chevron is another one. Reading some of the debates over the Chevron case, there's a conception of Chevron. I'm a defender of Chevron, I should say, but there's a conception of Chevron by which I didn't used to be. I was once upon a time an opponent in print of Chevron on separation of powers grounds. I no longer, I think that was a young person who was confused. But even if you like Chevron in the form that people like Chevron, the people who do like Chevron, the form in which they like it, has an insistence on both Chevron Step 1 and Chevron Step 2. Meaning if Congress has spoken clearly and the agency has run afoul of the clear instruction, then the agency loses. And even if the agency hasn't violated Step 1, if the agency's acted unreasonably, that might mean arbitrarily, the agency loses. So notice, if you would, that the current defenders of Chevron, and Justice Scalia was probably the apostle of Chevron in the early years, he, as he said in the Duke Law Journal, roughly, there's no one fonder of the system of separation of powers than I am. And he thought Chevron was a good reading of the separation of powers. Now, if you give up on Step 1...
Nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Come on. It's just jokes.
I'm thinking I agree with you. Boy, my young self was so imperfect. So keep in mind, if you would, that the debate between Chevron's defenders and Chevron's critics, it's along a pretty narrow band. So is it talking like Cerbero Croatian to refer to Kaiser Have I just gone into foreign language? Kaiser is a case which retains judicial deference, so to speak, to agency interpretations of their own regulations. Mm-hmm. Justice Gorsuch said that this is a zombie doctrine. And he meant that as it's dead. And the alternative view, it's the living dead. And that's okay, because there are cases in which a regulation is genuinely ambiguous, an agency is interpreting it reasonably, the court thinks, I don't know what that means. And you know, the big point of this stream of words you've just heard is that this is an intramural debate. The fact that it's an animated debate is completely fair and right, but it's an animated debate among people who are all committed to a strong conception of separated powers.
Just briefly, since we're running short on time, on our deference, which is the debt, you know, if the agency writes a regulation that is ambiguous or vague, then the courts must defer to it. I mean, that just seems to me like exactly the situation I described, and sort of the here's how the executive or a government official can coerce by will. You know, I mean, write a vague law and then go after who you want. And now, under our, we're supposed to defer to their interpretation of their own, you know, vague handiwork. But as Professor Sunstein says, I mean, there's a step one and step two. So the other point I was going to make just briefly is my single biggest surprise as a judge. And, you know, as a law clerk, I'd seen a lot of federal advocacy. My single biggest surprise as a judge is the representation of the United States in cases involving agency interpretations of statutes. Step one, if you ask a step one argument or question in oral argument, in my experience, 7 times out of 10, you get an indignant response of, Your Honor, this court owes us deference on that question. I mean, I can't even ask a question about the meaning of the text without counsel telling us that we should defer. And they, like, indignantly, I don't think it's an overstatement. I'll say to my clerks, I'm going to try to keep this really calm, okay? I'm not going to escalate. They're going to escalate. And and then if, you know, it goes where it goes. But my sense from, and this is what I call a secondary effect of Chevron, and it, like, the whole thing's been really hashed out very well in front of the Supreme Court, and they're going to do whatever they choose to do. But my own just observation, seeing this from a judge's standpoint, is that they're not trying to answer the same question we are. And so Hayek writes about this conspicuous difference in outlook between the administrator and the judge. And so the judge cannot bring any agenda, any concrete ends, as Hayek says it, other than upholding the legal order itself. That is the sole legitimate end in the world, the concrete end that the judge can bring. Because if I start bringing my biases in favor of the market order or this or that or the other thing, and I think it's just really important for the country that, you know, we do more about climate or, you know, do less about whatever it might be. If I bring those concrete ends into my interpretation of a statute, I am distorting that interpretation. And I am doing it in a way that people cannot predict in advance. When I'm using rules of construction that are known in advance, people can predict that. So the judge has a fidelity to the legal order, and you know, it's a matter of introspection, self-discipline, but you cannot bring your own substantive agenda to the decisions in these cases. Meanwhile, the agency head, and this is not an indictment. I mean, they have policy goals. You know, the EPA has goals of cleaning the water, cleaning the air. The SEC is trying to stop securities fraud. These are all good things. I'm not criticizing what they're doing, but the fact is, they do have concrete ends. And my observation is that they seem to pick the colorable interpretation, This is like, you know, for lay people, just like the remotely plausible interpretation that would most advance their policy end. It's just not the same question. And I think that they're so habituated to deference under Chevron that they actually go beyond colorable sometimes. I mean, I had a lawyer from civil appellate tell me not long ago that the statute was ambiguous. The key word in the statute, I forget what it was a pedestrian word, that it's ambiguous solely because it was not specifically defined by the statute itself. And Judge Sipar was on this panel with me. And I said, so like, how is it that we're having this conversation? You know, if the words are unknowable. So anyway, I'm sorry. That's just, I'm ventilating and I shouldn't do that. So anyway, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you can go or I can go, whatever.
I'll say the word you use that I fastened on is the word habituation. It might be that I published a book on that topic this week, maybe.
This week?
Maybe.
Aristotle?
Look Again, it's called.
Is it, okay. Yeah, get into Nicomachean ethics.
It's all about habituation. And habituation is diminishing sensitivity to stimuli. So if you go in a room that's a little smelly, after 20 minutes, you won't smell it. If there's a background noise in a room, you won't hear it after a while. If your life is quite great, there might be 18 things in it whose greatness you noticed originally, but not so much after a while. This is true for bad things as well as good things. So I'm thinking as we talk, the system of separation of powers and the commitment to the rule of law are things which it's very tempting to get habituated to treat them as background noise rather than a kind of amazing surprise that we get to have organize our lives. And so this is a good day for dishabituation. Thanks.
And I guess I would just say, again, sort of to look at the ends that the separation of power serves. So it in this unending battle between law and power, and this is, every generation is going to play its part in that battle. I mean, it just goes back and forth. And the separation of powers, I think, as it's spelled out in the federal constitution, gives a decisive advantage to law in that battle by making it so hard to coerce by will if you go through the rules as they're specified in the Constitution. So what does that do? That creates freedom. That creates what Hayek called a protected sphere, which is bounded by rules of conduct. And you can do whatever you want in there without any fear of coercion by the state or of other people. Because it keeps out other people too. That's why we enter into government. And so the state will use its coercive power to keep other people out, and you can make your plans and investments, and your company's not going to get nationalized or whatever it might be. And so people within the zone of freedom can then use their own knowledge of better ways to do things, of particular time and place. All these knowledge of circumstances and better ways of doing things, and then you have dispersed decision making by these individuals about how to allocate resources towards ends that they choose, using means that they come up with themselves. And the result, as Professor Sunstein has eloquently summarized in his Hayekian Behavioral Economics, you want to read a great 3-page primer. Up front, I mean, you can't do any better than what this man has written. But that allows free countries, free societies to harness a much greater share of the total knowledge possessed by individuals in those societies than any centrally controlled society ever could. The per capita GDP in Russia in like, you know, last year or two, 2%. 2% of the per capita GDP in the United States. And that's, among other things, it's because of the greater use of knowledge and the freedom that is created by by the separation of powers that we have here and that they very much do not have there. So again, I would just reiterate, I'm just honored to be on a stage with this gentleman, and I thank you for inviting me.